Hi everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. Adam Boileau had some work stuff come up this week, so he won't be joining us for this week's show, but that's okay because Alex Stamos is with us this week to talk through all the week's security news. Alex is at Stanford University in the United States these days, but previously served as the chief security officer of both Yahoo and Facebook. After we talk to Alex, it'll be time for this week's sponsor interview with VMRay's co-founder and sandbox guru, Carsten Willems. Carsten is joining us to talk product this week. VMRay has brought out a stack of new integrations for its sandbox product. You can now connect it up to a lot of your existing enterprise kit. That is an interesting chat. And it is coming up after this week's news segment, which starts now. And Alex, let's start off with a story from this part of the world. Trading on the New Zealand Stock Exchange has been halted for like a week because of a DDoS attack. And this attack was already happening before Adam and I recorded last week's show, but we didn't talk about it at the time because we weren't sure what the motivation was. The Christchurch massacre terrorist was sentenced last week, so we thought there could have been a political nexus to the attack, but no, it looks like fairly standard DDoS for ransom stuff.
Standard DDoS blackmail, but at a pretty big scale. 200 gigabits per second is what Akamai is saying that they're tapping off at, and pretty significant target, the New Zealand Stock Exchange. This is a little bit risky, just like the ransomware people who are going after critical national assets or things like hospitals where people are going to die. I think these guys are playing with fire. New Zealand's got a pretty serious intel capability. They're a Five Eyes country. And I wouldn't be shocked if doing things like going after the stock exchange ends up with these guys in the real crosshairs.
Yeah. So, I mean, they were able to take down the part of the NZX website that dealt with company announcements. And because they couldn't provide like appropriate access to company information, they had to suspend trading, and it's been up and down all week. So it is actually a pretty, it is actually a pretty big deal, this one. It looks like this is the same crew maybe that was pretending to be Russians like a couple of years. Well, they were pretending to be like Fancy Bear. They were like, we are Fancy Bear, send us your Bitcoins. And that was making some people on the receiving end of those emails feel very important for a time.
It's a nice little ego boost that you give to your victims. But I don't think this is how the GRU is monetizing their activity.
No, and it looks like one of the issues here was that NZX was hosting its DNS servers and its content servers on the same network, which is usually not a good thing to do.
We keep on seeing this, like very important pieces of infrastructure where people have not thought through and threat modeled what a DDoS looks like. And I do think, any organization of a reasonable size needs to have security assessments that don't just try to break in and to look at traditional intrusion, but to think through, if a DDoS attack happens, what is the thin part of your infrastructure that's going to fail first? And this is really interesting because, obviously most of the exchange is probably disconnected from the internet, on private networks, on lease lines and such. But like you said, if they can take down a web service and a website that is critical to the legal operation of the site, then it doesn't matter if the backend servers are still operating. They have to stop operation overall.
Yeah, this attack campaign is also targeting MoneyGram, Braintree, and other financial services companies. And we have linked through to a write-up on ZDNet by Catalin Kimpanu. Moving on, and we're doing things a little bit differently this week. We've got less news, and we're going to be doing some more in-depth discussions in a little bit, but we've got to whiz through some of the big news. And this is such a good one to discuss with you, because I know that this is the sort of thing that you pay close attention to. There's a big kerfuffle in the United States because the Democrats are saying they're no longer getting in-person briefings on election security from the DNI, and that this is apparently a terrible thing. I mean, I don't, as an outside observer, sitting here in Australia, I don't know how much of a big deal this is. It looks like they're still getting intelligence briefings. It's just that they're written. How much of this is Democrats playing politics versus the DNI playing politics?
I think part of this is Democrats playing politics in return for the DNI playing politics earlier this year. So, for your non-American listeners, especially, the Director of National Intelligence is a position that was created after September 11th to sit on top of the dozens of intelligence agencies the United States has, and to kind of take the big picture look of what do these agencies know, make sure they work together, and then debrief the public and the president. the DNI does not do direct collection themselves, right? So the office of the DNI, while containing lots and lots of people, they don't go out and do SIGINT. They don't have human spies or the like. They're taking information from the CIA, from the NSA, and other intelligence agencies.
And yeah, so we have an agency here called the Office of National Assessments, which is basically the same thing. But it's been around since 1977, so yay.
Yeah, so I'm sure we have a number of allies who are ahead of the curve on this one. But, you know, one of the core functions of DNI is then to provide a choke point of information between the intelligence agencies and the people who are supposed to provide oversight, both in the executive branch and in Congress. And one of the things that the DNI has already done this year was they came out with an assessment of what they believed countries would be doing during the US election. And a number of people, including myself, thought the assessment was massively politicized. They especially highlighted the idea that the Chinese were involved in election interference in the United States and were backing Joe Biden. And you know, like is normal for these kinds of things, they didn't show their work, which I find very frustrating in a situation where you're talking about disinformation, because if something was effective, then by definition, it was public and you should be able to point to something, and they pointed to nothing. After he was criticized for that, it looks like the DNI said that they are now not going to do live briefings for Congress, but just do answer written questions. I don't think this actually changes much operationally, right? Again, the DNI does not have much of an operational responsibility for election security. That is still, in the United States, mostly the purview of the Countering Foreign Influence Task Force, which is the FBI, DHS. NSA is also involved. All of those agencies are still involved in actually securing the election. And my understanding is that they will continue to be doing in-person briefings, at least behind closed doors, for Congress. But it is a little bit another sign of the politicization of our intelligence community in the United States, that the DNI just has refused to go in front of Congress, the people who give them all of their money, to fill them in on what's going on.
Yeah, so a bit of politics at play there on both sides, which is kind of what I thought might be the case. And look, speaking of, election security, there was a big kerfuffle earlier today that turned out to be a big nothing burger, which is, the apparent leak of Michigan voter data.
Right. And so this came from a Russian newspaper, had a story about people on Russian forums providing data files of here are voters that live in these specific states. And one person saying that he had turned this information in and gotten paid a bounty by the US State Department, who has a bounty program for people that report attempted attacks against the US election.
Yeah, they were like, yay, I got $4,000 from the State Department, which I don't know, citation needed is what I thought when I saw that.
And so this story got translated into English and then was picked up by a number of American journalists and kind of foreign policy experts who are not really cyber experts, who turned it into a big deal and acted as if this means the Russians are back. They have broken in Michigan. They've stolen all the data. Fortunately, it's completely untrue. This voter roll is public information in the United States. This is the exact database that anybody can go to the Secretary of State of Michigan and get access to. Now, there's lots of arguments that this data should not be available. There's a bunch of laws in the United States that data about individuals is available from the government, that these laws were in the 60s and 70s, and it made sense if you had to go into City Hall or some other building and look through huge books to figure out who was in the voter rolls.
I believe, and I'm not 100% sure that this is still the case, but last time I looked into it, that was the case here in Australia, is you actually have to go to a physical building and you can look at paper rolls. It's very important that voter rolls are public, right? Because you need some transparency there to make sure that there's no voter fraud, right? But in the United States, I am quite surprised to understand that you can't actually just obtain electronic copies of voter rolls.
Right. In some cases, you get like an actual database or a CSV file. In some cases, you get basically scanned printouts. But there are companies that then their entire OCR, business is right? They take like, those outputs and they OCR it. Yes. And they go fix it and they get rid of the typos and all that. And then they sell that to political campaigns, political parties, political action committees and the like. And so voter information is just out there. It is floating everywhere. This data, the fields exactly line up with the official database of the Secretary of State of Michigan. So it is absolutely public data. It was not stolen by anybody. The only story here is that some very smart Russian kid was able to get 4K possibly by ripping off the State Department, by fooling them, by showing them something that they just asked for free from the state of Michigan. But it demonstrates to me a bigger problem, which is everybody in the US is totally keyed up for the idea that somebody is hacking the election and we will jump at any shadow. The reporter, I'm not going to name her, but she's a respected person who's an expert in Russia, who was the original spreader of this, has not taken down her tweet. She's gotten something like 10,000 retweets of this original. She's supplemented it, with saying, oh, it looks like I was wrong. But it doesn't matter because the initial message is still what is spreading out there. And you have all of these celebrities and other folks saying the Russians are coming, the Russians are coming. And I think this is an incredibly dangerous direction for us to go, that anytime anything happens, we automatically assume that the election is forfeit because of a foreign adversary.
Yeah. Look, I agree with you. This is just a symptom of everyone being absolutely on edge and being very twitchy. Last week, Adam and I spoke about a late-breaking story, which was this gentleman was arrested trying to exit the United States after he apparently had offered the employee of a company $1 million to drop malware on the company network. You know, it was certainly an interesting piece, but we didn't know who the company was that these this crew was targeting. It turns out it was Tesla's Gigafactory. So it makes a lot more sense why the DOJ was like pumping up press releases and there was fanfare when they announced the charges.
Yeah, this was already being rumored because this was indictment was filed in the District of Nevada. There's not a lot of car manufacturing going on in Nevada. There's not a lot of heavy industry. And so the assumption from some people was that it was Tesla. But it is funny because the Department of Justice was very careful to remove all references to Tesla from their indictment. And then Elon Musk just blurted it out on Twitter.
And it's so funny, right? Because some outlet that follows, like, I think they focus mostly on like electric cars or whatever. They seem to be the first out of the gate saying that it was Tesla. So I figured they just, you know, by nature of their beat, they had sources inside who told this journalist. So then Kevin Collier saw my retweet of that and he's like, wow, do you have confirmation of this? You know, and he was really chasing hard. Like he's at NBC and he was really chasing confirmation super hard because he didn't want to just go out and, you know, do the irresponsible thing and confirm it when it hadn't been confirmed. So he spends a big chunk of his day trying to chase it down. And then Elon Musk just tweets, yeah, this was pretty serious, huh? And that was some.
So, I mean, journalists should just know, just ask Elon. He can't stand to be asked the same question three times. It's like Austin Powers. So if you just tweet something at him three times, he will confirm it.
Now, look, we're going to move on to another story now. And this one has, look, I think Brett Winiford, the author of our newsletter, Seriously Risky Business, if you're not subscribed, I would recommend you go and do so. I think Brett did the best coverage of this story. This week, a bunch of outlets reported that the United States was suing, had launched like this civil forfeiture action against a whole bunch, I think it was like 280 Bitcoin addresses and Ether addresses and cryptocurrency accounts. And it was reported as the United States trying to claw back Bitcoins stolen, you know, Bitcoins and other cryptocurrency stolen through attacks against cryptocurrency exchanges. Okay, fair enough. The problem with that, though, is if you actually read the documents that DOJ filed, the money is gone. Right? So they're not really trying to claw back the money, which begs the question, what's the point of the forfeiture action? And it looks to us like what this is really just showing North Korea that they can follow their money through chain hopping. And maybe this forfeiture forfeiture action is designed to put the people who assisted North Korea in laundering this this cryptocurrency that, you know, they could face some consequences in the future. Was that your read on this as well?
Yeah. So first off, I do believe you're right that Brent did a fantastic job with this write-up. And as you pointed out, the money is already in China. Or in Chinese organizations. And so the United States is not going to get it back. But I think that's a good read that, you know, if you look at the DOJ analysis, they have this beautiful chart tracking the Bitcoin as it flowed through multiple entities, either from Multigo or maybe it's Visio. It kind of looks like a Multigo chart. And I think what they are demonstrating here is you're totally right, is that they have the ability to track Bitcoin. They know if you are helping the North Koreans and you are on notice that maybe, you know, the North Korean hackers don't mind because they're never going to be able to leave their country / prison ever anyway. But there's a bunch of people in China and in other places who want to be able to travel to American allies one day, and that they might end up with sealed indictments if they keep on doing this kind of stuff.
Yeah, it looks like we agree on this, that this is kind of a warning.
Yeah, and if you're one of these American companies and your logo showed up on this chart that DOJ published, that is a significant warning too, right? Yeah. That you're not going to be allowed to continue to be a stopping point for for Bitcoin or Ethereum that was stolen by the North Koreans.
I think Cyber Command was actually involved in putting together that forfeiture action as well. So that's kind of interesting. Now, this next one comes to us via Krebs on Security. It's a very interesting piece. SendGrid, which is a bulk email supplier, they're having a tremendous problem at the moment with a wholesale amount of compromised accounts being used to send spam and whatever other nasties. And of course, compromised SendGrid accounts are very useful to spammers and phishing crews and whatnot, because they are allow listed into all sorts of wonderful places like major web email providers, et cetera, et cetera. So they are having a big problem right now. And a lot of this can be traced back to the fact that they don't use mandatory MFA on their accounts, which is something that, according to this piece at least, they're going to be looking to change. This is really a great example of how the absence of good security controls can completely bite you on the ass, isn't it?
It is. And like you said, email deliverability is a total black art. And these companies like SendGrid charge a lot of money to reliably deliver your email in bulk to companies like Microsoft and Google, who have very aggressive anti-spam teams that might disallow that in other circumstances. Their entire business is based upon the reputation of their mail exchangers. And if you have massive account takeovers and tons of spam moving through SendGrid, that puts their core business at risk. Now, it looks like the major providers like Google have not really moved aggressively to punish SendGrid, but that's only going to last for so long, right?
This directly
goes at kind of the reputation of the Google spam team. And so they are now deploying 2FA. They're going to need some more stuff. They're going to need probably some risk-based authentication. They're going to need much more aggressive scanning of outbound. It's kind of surprising, even with accounts taken over, that this kind of spam is making its way through SendGrid without setting off a ton of alarms. So I expect that this is going to be a wake-up call for them and their parent company, Twilio, who also has a variety of other businesses like SMS Relay, that are probably vulnerable to the same kinds of problems.
Now, we've seen another arrest in the Twitter hack. This is, of course, the hack where, it feels like a century ago, right? And it was only a few weeks ago, but this is when a whole bunch of...
Remember the before times?
Yeah. This is when a whole bunch of blue tick Twitter accounts, including like Joe Biden's account, started, tweeting out, I'm going to send you Bitcoin, just send some here and I'll send you back triple your money. And of course, there were people saying, oh my God, it's an attack from a sophisticated APT crew. And a lot of us were saying, well, it's probably just kids. We have confirmation that it's just kids. They've already been some arrests, but we've seen one more, this one aged 16 years old.
Yeah, they just get lower and lower here. This is getting a little more embarrassing for Twitter. When they finally pull like a 12-year-old out in front for a perp walk for breaking Twitter, that's gonna be a really rough day. It is teenagers, and it's not shocking based upon how these people utilize that incredible access or some of the early reporting of the discussions that were going on the OG forums where people are breaking into Twitter accounts and trading short Twitter accounts. So not shocking. It's also not shocking these guys are getting arrested. Their OPSEC is obviously horrible. They have all of these unencrypted communications. And I am sure that every single one who's been arrested has massively rolled over based upon the huge amounts of time that they're looking at. I hope that these guys have good lawyers and they end up getting reasonably good plea agreements, because I would hate to see 17-year-olds, not see the sun for 20, 30 years based upon what in the end was just a prank.
I mean, is that even a possibility in the United States? Because that just would not happen here, man. Like, you're not gonna lock someone up for like 10 years or something for doing this, like as a first
It's
offense.
Definitely a possibility. I mean, one of the problems here is a bunch of these charges can be served in series instead of concurrently, right? So if you hit them with like multiple Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, wire fraud and such, which is also why almost always people end up pleading out to these federal crimes, because the punishment otherwise is so, the risk that you're taking is incredibly high.
Well, and federal conviction rates are basically like, what, 99% or something, aren't they?
They're pretty high. I don't know if it's that high, but they're quite high, yes.
Yeah, rightio. Well, yeah, wouldn't want to be that kid. Moving on, and we've got a story here, another one from Catalin Kimpanu, saying Iranian hackers are impersonating journalists via WhatsApp and whatnot in order to build trust as part of a, sort of social engineering attempts against their targets. This is, you know, government-based stuff. They're targeting journalists from organizations like Deutsche Welle and the Jewish Journal from Israel. And look, this makes a lot of sense. I can remember having conversations with like Kevin Mitnick, and I'm talking a long time ago about how there are some misconceptions around social engineering and that it's, you know, you just make a call and you do the social engineering. A lot of it is about building up rapport. Once you have rapport and trust, people will do things for you that they wouldn't do for someone that they haven't met. So it does not surprise me to see that, you know, hackers working on behalf of the Iranian government are doing this sort of thing.
Yeah, and this is something the Iranians have been quite good for a while, right? Like they're not known for having the brand new ODEs or the beautiful malware or the best intrusion sets, but they are known for being pretty good at long-term social engineering. And a number of companies have uncovered these plots. We actually dealt with a couple of them when I was at Facebook, one of which Nicole Perroth wrote up of Iranians building these long relationships with people in the U.S. State Department and then turning that to try to take over those people's accounts and then find other Iranians who are actual dissidents. And so it is a way that the Iranian attackers like to even out the asymmetry of the amount of money and technical talent that they can throw at some of these issues.
Yeah. Now look, staying with Iran, and apparently some of their APT crews are like selling access to corporate VPNs on the dark web, right? And these are the companies that they may have breached through some auto-owned script targeting Pulse Secure or whatever. They might take a poke around, steal anything of interest, or the target might just not be that interesting to them. So now they're trying to monetize that access, which, look, I mean, as Adam and I would say, you know, great vertical integration there, guys, but it is a bit of a worry when you've got, you know, I mean, Iran these days, you would have to say, is pretty much a top tier operator, and having them just go after you and monetize access to your organization because they can, like, that's a bit of a worry.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, this is certainly pretty common in both Russia and China that you have groups that are operating on behalf of the state that will also monetize privately. I think there's an interesting question here of how much this has been sanctioned by the Iranian regime. You know, it's clear, like in Russia, that there's a number of groups where the Russians enjoy the fact that they don't have to pay these guys salaries and they still have them on call because they're making tons of money through account takeovers and Bitcoin theft and the like. You know, Iran's in pretty deep trouble right now economically, from COVID and such. And this might be a plan. This might be a decision by the state to allow people to do this because of budget issues. This could also be a sign of things kind of falling apart a little bit and individuals feeling that they can get away with making some with a side hustle, even if they're still taking you know, a paycheck from the Islamic Revolutionary Guard.
Yeah. I mean, you know, build up a bit of a Bitcoin stash in case things go south. I mean, if I was an operator working for an Iranian APT crew, that might not be the worst idea. Moving on, and we saw a big outage this week. We saw a 3.5% drop in global web traffic, apparently. Another one from Catalan here.
Yep. And again, one of those situations where lots and lots of people thought, oh my, this is it. This is the big DDoS. This is some huge attack.
No. It's always fat fingers. Always.
It's always fat fingers. In this case, a FlowSpec, which is a extension to BGP that you can use to configure firewall rules, that they made a change that had, as you often see in these kinds of BGP issues, that then had lots and lots of unintended downstream effects. And then the fact that the network is down makes it very difficult to recover because you have to go to your out-of-band communication regime to try to get things back. So yes, I mean, you don't see this too much from tier one providers, right? It's actually pretty rare for them to make a mistake like this. But when it happens, it has a big deal. And it had a big impact on Cloudflare, who's obviously clearly is like one of their bigger downstream customers. And so people were blaming Cloudflare or saying maybe it's a DDoS, but it turned out to be a tier one BGP issue.
Yeah. FlowSpec, which is like a BGP extension. Because when I first saw FlowSpec, I'd never really heard of it. I'm like, wow, it wasn't BGP. And then I read further and I'm like, oh, okay, it was. Of course it was.
Right. There's all this cool stuff that's really just like BGP, the old protocols underneath, including BGP.
Now, look, we got some news here that relates to a sponsor of Risky Business, actually. Signal Sciences has been bought by Fastly, which is essentially a CDN provider, for $775 million. This isn't the sort of news that we normally cover in the news segment of Risky Biz, but I thought this is pretty interesting because now you've got, you know, gluing those two things together, gluing together like a web security platform like Signal Sciences with a massive CDN, it just makes so much sense. I can't wait to see what they come up with once they're finished integrating these two things.
Yeah. So full disclosure, I was an investor in Signal Sciences. I'm a good friends with a couple of the founders, including Zane Lackey, who you've had on your show multiple times and who I gave him his first job out of college. Just, you know, for those of us who have had reasonably long careers in InfoSec, being able to work with incredible people and see them succeed like this is one of the best parts of the career. In this case, I think you're right. This is a very smart move by Fastly. And they seem to be positioning themselves in the market between Cloudflare and Akamai, right? Akamai is still seen as the very high-end enterprise. You have to talk to a sales guy in a sport coat to get a contract and to get set up. But they have the largest network and kind of, you know, a lot of the enterprisey features. Cloudflare has a lot of freemium customers, some of whom you do it for very abusive things. And so that's like has a big reputational hit on Cloudflare. But they still have, you know, they're making a decent amount of money on people upgrading and paying. And Fastly is inserting themselves into that market of both a CDN and a reverse proxy that can provide a bunch of security features that is easy to deploy and easy to integrate, easier than Akamai, but perhaps does not have kind of the free tier problems that you see from Cloudflare.
I think one of the amazing things about Signal Sciences, and again, you know, we've both disclosed that you had a financial interest in Signal Sciences. You know, you were an early stage investor, so I'm guessing you just made yourself a butt ton of money out of this. So congratulations, that's great. And, you know, we, I think, did our first sponsored thing for Signal Sciences. It was either pre-Series A or just after. So they've been with us for a long time. The cool thing is the reason that they went from nothing to like a nearly $800 million acquisition in the space of like really just a few years is because they came up with a WAF that you could just install and then more or less just, you know, turn it on to full blocking and it would just work, right? So the security gains that I think a lot of Fastly's customers are going to get by just flipping the switch on this are going to be quite substantial. It's unusual to see an acquisition that actually makes this much sense. I even remember maybe 6 months ago talking to Zane and I'm like, when are you going to get a CDN integration together? Because that's obviously where this stuff is going. And he said, oh no, we're working on something. And yeah, boy, was he.
And I think Signal Sciences is actually a good lesson for other people in the security industry. Like you said, one of the reasons they got so big was they're easy to use. And you know, this is not the most full-featured WAF that you can get. It's possibly not even the most secure WAF. Definitely doesn't have the most checkboxes, but it was the easiest WAF you could deploy.
Yeah.
And I think that's what a lot of security companies miss, is they come up with this, what they consider this incredible idea. They have this very great solution to a difficult technical problem, but they're often founded by people who didn't have real operational experience. And the founders of Signal had real problems. They're at Etsy, real operational problems, and they took the lessons of the problems they solved and they deployed that into their product. And I think that's what you should be thinking about if you're building a security product, is the first thing about it is it has to be easy to use and low risk for people to deploy. All of the other stuff comes later.
Yeah, yeah, 100% agree on that. Now, look, I just want to quickly mention this Cisco bug. I've seen multiple reports of this. Oh my God, there's a Cisco O-Day being exploited in the wild. Now, look, I'm not downplaying this. I just want to clarify. It looks like this is actually some sort of DOS condition involving memory exhaustion, right? So especially targeting like telco grade stuff. Now, having a trivially exploitable DOS condition in your core routers, yeah, I mean, that's going to keep a few people awake at night. But this is kind of doing the rounds at a bunch of outlets like it's actually RCE, and it's just not.
Yeah, there's no indication it's RCE yet. Of course, every time people say that, they end up getting embarrassed, right? So please do not write down that Alex and Patrick said that it'll never be RCE. I mean, there is the possibility that this, you know, people start to dig into it and that some genius figures out how to make it exploitable. But like you said, it is kind of a big deal to be able to reboot these systems. You know, core routers at large networks and large enterprises don't get rebooted that often. They don't get patched that often. So the fact that, you know, a bunch of maintenance windows are getting opened up in emergency time this week is going to be a big issue for a number of enterprises. But I this is certainly not a, you know, the worst bug even of this month.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Now, look, and that's the thing. Like, as I say, I'm not trying to trivialize it, but it just seemed like the attention it was getting was outsized. Now, look, we're going to actually wrap up the discussion of the news, right, of the week's breaking news, and move on into, you know, a bit of a deeper dive into a couple of issues. And they're things that I've been wanting to discuss with you, actually, because I know that they're topics near and dear to your heart. We're going to talk about the whole WeChat, TikTok drama, and also tie that into a bit of a discussion about the announcement of an initiative initiative out of the U.S. State Department that it's about a month old now. It was first announced on August 5. The Clean Network Program, right? So this is Mike Pompeo put out this release on the State Department website saying the United States is going to pursue a clean network initiative. And when you first read it, it sounds great, right? They're going to only, you know, connect to clean carriers. They're only going to have, you know, clean app stores, clean apps, clean cloud, clean cable, right? But it does, you know, I mean, it sounds cool, but it feels like there's a bit of magical thinking in this. Why don't you start off by describing to us what the State Department's Clean Networks Initiative is, and then tell us what you think about it.
So this is, we don't know a lot about this other than the press release that was released by the State Department. And what I have heard from some people who have worked inside the government is that this mostly came out of the White House and did not go through the normal process by which people consider these kinds of things and think through all the consequences, which is not unusual for how we unfortunately make law in the United States these days. First off, the terminology is kind of nuts, right? The idea of like, you know, clean meaning that like if a Chinese person is on your network, it is dirty. I just don't like the terminology at all. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to take a very complicated issue, which is the very real risks that are posed by the People's Republic of China and the Chinese Communist Party, both to their own citizens, as we're seeing in the western side part of that country, but also to people around the world, and try and take all of these complex issues and make it a very simple idea of the network being clean, meaning not Chinese. And I think it's, you know, I see why they're trying to do it from a marketing standpoint, but it really does not hold together because you're talking about some very different kinds of problems when we talk about them, you know, and it ends up with you coming up with these massive oversimplifications. So, you know, there are five different lines of effort, and you name some of them, but like one of them, clean carrier, to ensure untrusted People's Republic of China carriers are not connected to U.S. telecommunication networks. So I'm not sure what that means other than, you know, are they saying that if there's internet routability between North America and China, that is like automatically the internet is unclean? Does that mean that phone calls should not be able to be completed? Does that mean that people should not be able to get on Microsoft Teams?
I think they mean they would prefer that the telcos operating the links between the United States and China are American owned, right? And look, we've done some coverage, and Brett did some excellent work on this, but we've done some coverage on the whole China telecom issue. They were given a show cause, like a 30-day show cause for why they shouldn't be kicked off, you know, their connections are basically, you know, clipped between China and the United States. That time period lapsed and we've seen no news since then. It's only Brett is the only one who noticed because he's got an alert for this and he just, you know, it's been crickets, right? But I think the idea that China Telecom, like if there was C2 infrastructure on China Telecom infrastructure and the United States kicked up a stink about it, they'd never pull it down, right? So in that way, I can see the appeal of saying, okay, well, that's it. You can't connect to us anymore.
Okay, so China Telecom is definitely not a good actor. Anybody who's hung out on the NANOG list for more than a couple of weeks will have seen, you know, another accidental advertisement by China Telecom of some IP address range that just happens to correspond with some
embassy
critical
or something.
Part of American industry.
Whoops.
Yeah, or Lockheed Martin or something. Yeah, just a totally random fat finger from China Telecom. So I'm not defending the People's Republic of China is the most aggressive and most capable country in the use of a variety of different techniques, but including, you know, direct network intrusion, as well as the subversion of their own networks to benefit the ruling party and for signals intelligence purposes. Not defending China here. I just don't think that this is like a intellectually consistent way to handle it. And some of these things are just not going to work. We're not going to be in a future where a phone call, you know, short of World War III, where you can't email somebody in China or a phone call is not going to connect, right?
But I don't think that's
like
what's
this
being
very
proposed.
Basic idea. It's like a very basic conception of how the internet works. And I kind of wish that somebody who really knew how these things operated was in the White House or at the top of the State Department to go tell them that like, this is just a completely unrealistic set of goals. And so you're setting yourself up for something that's going to be laughed out of the room by all of our allies.
Look, I mean, I can see what you're saying, but at the same time, I think that's you're actually being a little bit unfair to the Trump White House, and I can't believe that I just said those words. But I don't think the goal here is to completely
you're getting email.
I don't think the goal here is to completely disconnect China from the internet. I think it really is a matter of, you know, the United States can't really control all of the multitude of paths that get to that China Telecom landing in the United States. Whereas if it was like an American company operating those links, operating those beachheads, it gives you more control. And if China was a more responsible actor, this wouldn't even be a discussion, right? So like I can kind of see, like with each of these points, you're right. It's written in a way that is kind of icky and reactionary. But at the same time, they're not in and of themselves bad principles, right? And that's where I get that whole cognitive dissonance thing going on here. Should we even allow things like Chinese social media apps into Five Eyes app stores when we know those things are going to get leveraged by Chinese intelligence?
Right. So I think the ones that are the most defensible and that are the ones I agree with is the cloud storage of data, what they call clean cloud. To a certain extent, clean apps and clean store, right? Which is about what Chinese apps are on phones in the United States and what kinds of assurances we should have about that code. Back to the cable stuff, you're saying like they want American companies to control it, but there was actually a cable between LA and Hong Kong that was going to be run by an American company that had investors like Google and Facebook in it that the State Department scrapped just because it's landing in Hong Kong. And first off, the United States has no position to tell the rest of the world that you can't tap fiber optic cables. We are the greatest tappers of fiber optic cables around the world. And second, realistically, you can't stop it, right? The mitigation for these kinds of risk is the encryption of data as it moves over backbones. It is not to assume that the fiber cables themselves are physically secure. That's just impossible.
Yeah.
But yes, on these other ones, I think there's some reasonable goals. I think part of this, though, is also Donald Trump really dislikes TikTok. He dislikes it for domestic political reasons in the United States. And they are trying to come up with a post hoc intellectual rationalization for that.
So you think that's what this is? This is a post hoc intellectual rationalization that will justify squashing a platform that hates him?
Well, not just squashing TikTok. They want to expand this and make this part of an overall assault on Chinese tech. And I think the United States really should be thoughtful and more aggressive about Chinese tech companies and the operation of American tech companies in China. I just don't see this happening because it also is not very thoughtful about the risk that this poses of setting up rules that will benefit American companies that rely completely on Chinese operations. And the person who should be the most afraid of this press release is Tim Cook, right?
Because totally, man. I was going to mention this because like the biggest winner out of all of this, right, is going to be Google. Because Android allows third-party app stores, right? So you will still be able to load up WeChat, TikTok, whatever, right? If you are a Chinese person based outside of China, you will still be able to get these apps and you will still be able to stay in touch with family. It is going to kill iPhone sales dead in China if there is a ban on these apps appearing. And look, there's the political dimension to it as well, which is that people in China are already pretty pissed off. Like I'm just talking ordinary people about the United States approach to the Huawei issue, right? So right. If this escalates, we could start to see consumer boycotts of products like iPhones, and that's going to be really bad for Apple. Now, whether or not this results in a company like Tencent actually developing its own phone OS, I'm not sure. I don't necessarily think it'll go that far when people can just use Android and it's fine, but there are some genuine second-order effects here.
There are, right. And Apple's in the toughest spot. One, because like you said, their app store, they're the only ones that run an iPhone app store. And this basically implies that the United States wants to use the fact that Apple is headquartered in California as leverage to control what is in the Chinese app store. Apple will never let that happen.
Even if these apps are still allowed in the Chinese app store, they're used to communicate with the diaspora. If you are a Chinese person who can afford an iPhone, chances are you've got a child maybe in college in the United States, right? And are you going to use an iPhone when you can't talk to your kid because all other chat apps are kind of blocked in China? Like the whole thing is just such a mess. And it comes back to this idea that one of my criticisms of the State Department stuff is that they are looking at this from the point of view of like, if you were just starting the internet, this would be a great idea, a great set of principles. But really what they're trying to do here is unblend the smoothie and it just doesn't work.
Yeah. And it's the United States and China are going to be deeply enmeshed economically and socially for the entire 21st century, assuming that we don't go to war, right? And that's not what we should want. We should want to figure out a way that these two superpowers can coexist in a, perhaps somewhat unfriendly, but at least a a hot piece, right? And this is not the direction to do it. This assumes the ability for the United States to cut these links, which would be a complete disaster for a huge number of American companies. Apple's at the top, but you know, a huge chunk of the Fortune 500 has significant exposure either for employees or vendors in China or for China as a huge market of theirs. And so you're talking about massive economic damage to the United States. And just realistically, you know, something like the internet, unless all of our allies sign up for some kind of, you know, limiting, dropping China telecom at, you know, at their edge routers or, you know, some other kinds of limitations, then it's completely useless, right? And I just see us on a path right now where the United States, the government is going to do the most damage possible to America's position in the world, to American businesses with the least amount of actual security benefit. And that's just, it's just really sad.
Well, and that's where the cognitive dissonance part comes in for me, because on one hand, I think, yeah, you probably don't want a massive social media platform being owned and operated by a Chinese company in the United States, because that information is absolutely going to be used. That's going to become one of their big data sets, and they will find creative ways to use that to identify CIA officers in 20 years from now, right? Because that's just how this stuff works. So, you know,
today's TikTok influencers are tomorrow's CIA officers.
Well, but yeah, when you've got like, you know, 50% of young people on the platform or something, that is actually the case, right? So, and you know, we got a story here from Wired about how WeChat censored certain phrases related to COVID-19 during the, you know, the pandemic outbreak in China. These apps, you know, they come with pretty serious problems. The question is how to best engage on that issue. And maybe that's where we can agree that that's not been the part that's been done particularly well. We've also got a story here from the Financial Times. I hadn't heard about this. Brett actually found this out and put it in the newsletter. I fired it up for an edit yesterday and my jaw hit the desk. But it looks like China might be trying to piss in the punch a little bit here and actually block the sale of TikTok to American interests, which is just, I mean, it's really everyone's positioning themselves so that the other one just can't win.
That's right. And this is completely predictable, is that there's no way that the CCP was just going to allow a Chinese company to be forced to sell to an American company like this. It's such a precedent that they cannot live with. And so even if this means ByteDance dying or having their market cap significantly reduced because they're not able to operate in a bunch of Western countries, that's probably in the long-term interest of China to prevent this kind of deal from happening. So this is going to be very tough. The ByteDance people are an incredibly difficult situation. And you know, the other data point we have here is that the CEO of TikTok, who was formerly an executive at Disney, who was hired to be kind of the American face of this company, quit right before a bunch of this stuff came out. And it's quite possible that he was caught in this impossible situation between Beijing and DC and decided that he couldn't walk that tightrope anymore.
Let's move on now. We got one more topic that I actually wanted to cover off with you because this is funny, right? So I think like a month or so ago, Signal pushed like an update to its Electron desktop app and it's got video calling and it looks really fantastic. And I was really jealous of everyone showing screenshots of their wonderful Signal experience. And I got into our Slack and I was like, you know, I wish I could run the Electron Signal app, but I just don't feel comfortable running Electron apps because, you know, Brendan Scarville, who's an Australian researcher, did some absolutely terrific work on Electron security back in 2018. And I was lucky enough to sit through his talk at TuskCon. And there was like 12 people at this talk. It was a tiny little, that edition of TuskCon, there were like 25 people there, right? So we're all sitting in the in a nice little outdoor tent while Brendan just scared the willies out of us by showing us the attack surface of Electron. Ever since I saw that talk, and look, there have been improvements made to it since, but ever since I've seen that talk, I've been absolutely like just terrified of Electron apps to the point where I don't run them. The only one that I've run is Skype and it gets fired up once in a blue moon and then shut down, right? That's it. I don't like to run them. And the reason is because you can take something like a cross-site scripting bug in a bit of web code, and you can escalate that into pretty reliable RCE. And that is not a good place to be in. So I fired off a tweet, right? This is just the other day, saying, don't run Electron apps. And I quote tweeted Daniel Cuthbert, who'd dug up some details on a bug that it was reported to Slack earlier this year. And that detailed a flaw. It was one of those XSS to RCE bugs, right? Affecting the Slack desktop client. Now, look, I am not one of those people who's like, oh, don't run apps, you know, don't, you know, shut down everything, eat your phone, drown your computer. I am not one of those people, but I just don't feel comfortable running those sort of apps. If I need to use Signal, I use it on my phone. If I need to use Slack, I fire it up in a browser tab. And people say the user experience isn't as good. I don't care, because the types of bugs that I've seen in Electron absolutely scare the willies out of me. Now, I sent off this tweet. It's had like 100 retweets. It's had hundreds of likes. And what was really interesting is it pulled a whole bunch of people into the discussion. Justin Hsu from Google, who works on the Chrome security team, was in there basically agreeing that there's problems. We actually had the person who's responsible for securing the Slack Electron app jump into the thread at one point and say, well, since this bug report, we've turned on a lot of the security features. We're in a much better place. There are changes being made. Moxie Marlinspike even quoted from the thread and did a thread of his own. He finished his thread by saying that Electron seems to be in a chasm where it has enough energy in it to be the only viable option for like cross-platform app development. But because it has such a small total market, there's not enough energy or an investment into it, you know, for it to rapidly improve. And I thought he really hit the nail on the head. But while you're here, I just wanted to get your thoughts on Electron, because look, frankly, using Electron instead of writing a mess of your own C++ is probably going to result in a more secure app if you do it sensibly. But my philosophy is, wherever possible, use a browser tab. What do you think of this?
Yeah, so, you know, I totally understand the attraction of Electron is that each one of these companies does not want to have to maintain 5, 6, 7 different code bases for different platforms. They want to write it once and then make minor changes to be able to ship everywhere. In some ways, though, it is the worst of all worlds, right? So, you know, it is using memory-safe languages, and everybody assumes, okay, great, you can't have a buffer overflow or use after free. You're not going to get RCE. But as you've pointed out, all these people have figured out ways that now XSS, which is the kind of bug you have a lot of when you're handling tons of user input, like a Slack or a Discord or a Signal, that you can turn XSS into RCE. And I think there's a couple of different issues here. There's the Electron project itself, which it does seem is under-resourced from a security perspective. This is kind of where we were 5, 6 years ago with OpenSSL, when there was a series of really critical OpenSSL bugs. And it turns out OpenSSL that everybody was using for everything important was being maintained by like two guys in the basement and a bunch of companies threw money in. So there is a possibility that because of these issues that you're going to see Microsoft, Slack, a couple other big companies really invest in.
I believe that's the case. I believe Slack actually has some resources dedicated towards improving Electron, and that makes. And I think in part because of this bug report that came to them on HackerOne back in April. They only disclosed it recently, but it was a doozy, right? And that would have been enough of a wake up call. But I don't think one or two full time resources is gonna do it. We need, and that's the thing, right? You're talking about something that essentially has the attack surface of a browser. In fact, a bigger attack surface than a browser, and you're expecting a handful of ad hoc resources to be able to secure it to the same level as something like Google Chrome, it ain't going to happen.
Right. And that is the structural problem with Electron, is that you're shipping a browser runtime where the runtime is bundled with the app and cannot be updated by itself, right? And so, you know, when you talk about a web app having a vulnerability, if that vulnerability relies upon an issue in Chrome underneath, you've got the Chrome team doing, you know, slipstreaming updates on an almost weekly basis, and perhaps having that bug closed in 24 hours. Whereas for Electron, it has to be put, you know, somebody has to figure it out. They have to push in Electron, and then that has to go downstream, and all of the apps that run on it have to update it separately. And so I think that is going to be one of the long-term architectural problems, is that bugs just last way too long. And on these, you know, in these kinds of web platforms, patching the bug quickly is one of the critical things. And that will never get fixed with Electron. The other issue is that a lot of the people that, by definition, if you're building an Electron, you don't have your people probably don't have a lot of experience with the low-level security issues with any given operating system. So you don't have the engineers and the security people that have the experience necessary to do that kind of work. Unlike the browser teams, where the browser teams, you know, Chrome had people who understood how, you know, Windows permission tokens in the Windows kernel work, as well as Microsoft employees to build the Chrome sandbox back in the day. You don't have folks like that at a place like Slack that's using Electron. Their whole goal is to not have to hire low-level C++ engineers. And I think that is also one of those fundamental architectural issues, is that, you know, when you add these layers of abstraction up over and over again, it makes it really easy to introduce these flaws. And all security researchers have to do is pierce those levels of abstraction and understand the functioning of things underneath. So I'm a big fan of progressive web apps. I think, yeah, we should not be relying on Electron for this. We should use PWAs. It those run out of a runtime, the browser that is updated on its own, that is maintained by dedicated security teams. That one of the things holding back PWAs is, again, Apple. Apple doesn't like them. They don't like the idea of anything threatening their app store monopoly on iOS devices. And so PWAs have become less interesting to app developers because there's a couple of major platforms owned by Apple that don't really support them. But I do think that is a much better direction because there's no reason why you can't get all the benefits out of a progressive web app that you get from the Slack desktop, but plus the security benefits that the Chrome team normally gives you.
Well, and thank you, because that's exactly how I feel about it, right? Which is like, just no. And again, Brendan Scarville's research from 2018, I mean, you just look at how you can take, as you said, a very common type of bug. And then, you know, it really reminds me of that Anchorman line that escalated quickly, you know,
right?
Because you just take this tiny little bug and then next thing you know, it's game over time, right?
And 2 years, that's like dog years in security, right?
Yeah.
Like it's ridiculously long period of time.
It is. And then there were people jumping into that thread defending Electron. And fair enough, right? There have been meaningful improvements made and there's a bunch of very smart, well-intentioned people working on it. But you're expecting me to feel comfortable with it when we've just seen details of that Slack bug that was like XSS2RCE that was disclosed in April this year. You want me to believe that it's changed so much since April this year? And look, big part of that was actually Slack not enabling security features that they should have enabled. But you're expecting me to believe that this sort of app ecosystem has made strides in that short amount of time that are going to make me feel comfortable using it? No, I tell you, no.
Yeah, I totally agree. And you know, PWAs are out there. I just wish that we would get the app developers to give up the responsibility of having to maintain this stuff themselves.
Yeah, I'm not holding my breath for Apple to really let that happen, because as soon as you've got PWAs on, you know, in Safari tabs, like why use an app store?
Yes. And you know, it is amazing how all these stories actually line up, right? Like we're talking about kind of monopoly issues with Apple lining up with their exposure in China, lining up with the vulnerabilities that are created by Electron apps. It is amazing that like the entire tech industry, there are really only three or four different major issues. And all of these things are the downstream effects of kind of these huge struggles between these companies.
It's very interesting that you say that, because that didn't occur to me that would actually be a way for Apple out of this situation, is to enable PWAs so that WeChat could just run in a Safari tab, right?
Right. Like, yes, if it was running on a Safari runtime, but as a desktop and with all of the kind of, I mean, the big thing with PWAs that would be lacking on iOS would be the notification. So you would have to kind of plumb in a notification event framework using their routing. But yes, that would solve a lot of things.
Now, before we go, I just wanted to mention that Brian Krebs has written a two-part series called Confessions of an ID Theft Kingpin, and that is about this guy, Hieu Minh Nho, who is a Vietnamese gentleman who spent 7 years in prison in the United States for, you know, selling fools, and Brian's written up a really interesting two-part feature on this.
Yep, it's a great feature. You know, what's interesting to me is that this gentleman's Vietnamese. Vietnam is the next China in a lot of ways, right? You have the Vietnamese government operating attack groups, but then you also have a lot of domestic Vietnamese groups that are getting really aggressive in both the cybercrime and kind of patriotic hacking. So it's a really interesting country to pay attention to.
Yes, it is. So that's sort of our reading item for this week. It's our reading list item. Alex Stamos, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to wrap it up there. So thanks a lot for joining us and for filling in for Adam this week, who couldn't make it. It's been a real pleasure to chat to you, and we'll do it again soon.
Thanks, Patrick.
That was Alex Stamos there with a look at the week's security news. And yeah, it's probably not entirely fair to say Apple doesn't completely support PWAs. They do, but the general consensus is they don't work quite as well. They're not as well supported on Apple platforms as on others. So there is something to what Alex says. And I think, you know, this whole thing is just more evidence. PWA stuff is like more evidence that the browser is the OS and that's not necessarily a bad thing. Well, the browser is becoming the OS, I should say. And maybe that's not the worst thing that could happen. Anyway, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Carsten Willems. He more or less invented the contemporary sandbox during his time at university before going on to co-found this week's sponsor, VMRay. They make a malware sandbox that you can use to do sample analysis or even just auto risk scoring for files you throw at it. And VMRay has really moved on from the days where it just sold its sandbox analyzer to IR teams and malware analysts. These days, you can use their sandbox as a detection tool by integrating it with some of your existing tools. Here's Carsten explaining how VMRay is helping organizations do what he calls ATD.
So ATD is an abbreviation for advanced threat detection, and it's just a fancy term for sandboxing. There are some other techniques nowadays being used for ATD, like machine learning-based classification, stuff like that. But in the end, it's sandboxing. And ATD is an important component of many different security solutions nowadays. So every email security, web security, endpoint security, you name it, have some form of sandboxing component built in. The problem with these solutions is that sandboxing for them is only one feature out of many. Yeah, so an email security product has anti-spam, anti-phishing, identity management, encryption, blah, 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 all the things. And in addition, they have also ATD. And usually they use an open source tool or just build something on a best effort base. But these are good, but not good enough. And the whole idea of our new platform is to give our clients an engine that they can connect to every single security solution they have already in place and add premium ATD capabilities. So if you deploy VMRay connected to your email product, then your email security can now, from now on, also detect advanced new zero-day malware. If you connect it to your proxy product through an ICAP interface, then your downloads are protected, and you can do the same for network, endpoint, and cloud. Now, so instead of building all these products, which we didn't want to do, we just built an engine with integration options, so you can simply augment what you already have instead of replacing the tools.
I mean, this is something I've said on the show quite a few times now, which is this is kind of the way the industry is going, where everybody's going to work on their own specialist little niche, and we just glue it all together because everything's API-ified now, right?
Exactly. It's something in between of consolidation requirements on one hand and best of breed usage on the other hand. So I know how complicated it is to buy a new security solution. It takes years for first making the decision, hey, we need a new tool. Second, doing all the POCs, then doing the legal stuff, then doing the rollout in 20 data centers. So replacing a solution doesn't really work. And if you can give them a very specialized capability to add on what they already have, so you can have best of both worlds. Yeah, you don't have to replace the solution, but you can get best of breed functionality at the same time. And the cool thing is that you cannot use VMRay only for email, but you can use it for web, you can use it for endpoint, you can use it for cloud, and you can use it for your IDS. So everywhere in the organization.
It's funny that you mention endpoint, right? Because one of the companies that I work with a bit here in Australia is called Airlock Digital, and they do what used to be called whitelisting and is now called allow listing. And, you know, people make decisions on files. They can throw them through a sandbox or whatever. But ultimately, when you think about what an allow list platform is it's essentially an orchestration platform for decisions. There's no reason that you actually need a human being making those decisions. You can just start throwing binaries at platforms like yours if you want to automate those decisions. That's fine. I feel like that's the way a lot of this stuff is going to go, right?
Yeah, I mean, our whole mission for the incident response part is to make the security teams and the security operation of our clients better in terms of more effective and more efficient, because we give them less noise, we give them more automation, and we give them the right tools so that they only have to put their focus on what is really relevant, and all the stuff that can be automated should be automated. On the other hand, it's a bit dangerous just to automatically using allow lists, yeah, or this threat intelligence data, and use it to block stuff on the network, because there's a lot of low quality threat intelligence data, specifically when it's open source and there's no vendor behind it on the internet. So it's really, I mean, you don't want to block Google, you don't want to block Office 365 just because your tools talk to each other in a very seamless way and there is no person really
And there was a malicious, you know, Azure app, or you don't want one of your tools flagging OneDrive as malicious because there was some malware there, right? Like, I think that's what you're saying. But I guess what I meant by, you know, treating allow listing software as an orchestration platform for a decision engine, which is kind of the business that you're in, is that once you can start swapping around the decision engines, whether that's the VMray API or a competitor's API, all of a sudden, you are only competing with your competitors on two metrics, price and efficacy. That's it. It's like about as close to a meritocracy as you're actually going to get.
Yeah, that is exactly the reason why we wanted only to build that engine and don't want to build a full-fledged email security suite, web security suite, endpoint, blah, 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 because there are so many features like this all anti-spam and email encryption and identity management that already have been built 100 times. And we didn't want to put our time into that. We want to focus on where we are very good at advanced threat detection, dealing with zero-day malware. And we found a way how we can really focus on this value. And as you said, we are no longer compared to having all these other features that don't really add to the efficacy factor, right?
So who do you want to actually become your customer here? Do you want the end users to actually license your platform, you know, buy a license and start throwing a stream of files at your technology? Or do you want the vendors themselves to license it? What's the play here?
I mean, in the end, it's the same. It's the same customer market as we had in the past. So we all our customers, they have in common that they have mature security teams. So they already have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different security solutions. And if they really want to add on top of that, then they're going for premium and close the gap products like VMray. So still, we're selling to large enterprises, government agencies, and other tech vendors. But when it comes to end customers, yeah, we have some third-party integrations out of the box, like Carbon Black, for example. We have a very few OEMs, but mainly we are offering connectors that make it very easy for the security teams to integrate themselves. So, for example, for email, we have an Office 365 integration. It's just a few clicks to add it on top of it. For on-prem customers, we have an MTA, so you can VMray run next to your existing email security solution and just add one additional layer of security. For web security, we have an ICAP interface, so you can plug it into your proxy. It's not that much about having our tech being built into other products, but being connected to. Yeah, because it's important to have connectors to all your security products and not only improve your email security. Yeah, that's the cool thing.
I mean, it's possible these days, right? It wasn't. I mean, it wasn't too long ago that trying to do these sort of integrations, like going into an enterprise and saying, we can actually interface with the existing kit you've got, that was fantasy talk, right?
Yeah, and even today we see some pushbacks from the big vendors who don't want to open, of course, their APIs to competitors. I mean, I wouldn't do that as well if I were them. But there are ways and methods how you can do it, and specifically with having going into the cloud and with being more specific, dedicated engines. It's becoming more and more possible. And actually, if there's a big customer behind, yeah, who tells company XYZ, hey, we want to add VMray to your tool, or we will go somewhere else, then once a customer is part of that negotiation, it becomes much easier, of course. And since we have very, very large brands as customers nowadays, yeah, we have more leverage in these discussions.
Now, there's a feature you wanted to discuss while you were here, and you're calling it, and I hate this sort of terminology, but I'm going to go for it anyway. you're calling it link detonation. What is that?
Okay, so what do we do here? I mean, let's go a bit back in history. So in the beginning, all malware was executables. Yeah, so we use sandboxes to execute unknown files and find out if it's dangerous or not. Then malware has shifted to being a document because executables were blocked at the email solution, so Office files and so on and so forth. Then malware has changed to become script languages, PowerShell, blah, 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 because the security solutions also block documents. And today, still email is the main infection vector, but it is usually links. Yeah, it's links leading to a malicious website where there's a drive-by or there's some phishing campaign. So it's been a link being inside of an email. Sometimes it's in a benign attachment. Nevertheless, it's a link. And the typical response to that is to replace these links and do URL rewriting So you replace these things with safe links. And that means that eventually when a user clicks on a link that he has received via email, then the URL is checked against a reputation database. And if you are lucky, because you are not the first person that is being hit by this malware, but somewhere else before, then the link, the URL is on the not allowed list, yeah? And then you're protected. So this is time of click detection, which is good, but it has some downsides. But on the other hand, you can also detonate a link, a URL in a sandbox if you have proper technology. And then you can already at the time of delivery decide if a link is malicious or not. And that has several upsides. And the cool thing is that with our approach, you can combine time of click with time of delivery detection, because we are the only ones who can detonate URLs in a sandbox to find out what is going on.
But hang on, when you detonate it in a sandbox, what are you looking for? Are you looking for some sort of binary being flung at you through a browser exploit? I mean, I'm guessing you're not looking for phishing pages. Like, what are you actually looking for?
It's both. First, you have to decide if it's safe to detonate a link, because, you know, you get emails with a lot of activity links. Yeah, subscribe to a mailing list, desubscribe, buy a Ferrari, whatever. And if you just detonate all the links that are being sent to you, there's a lot of activity triggered that you don't want to. Yeah, so you first have to decide if it's safe or not. And we have a good approach to solving that problem. Then we start the sandbox, open the URL, and then we do all our sandboxing magic. Yeah, so even with standard malware, it's important that you simulate user behaviors. You click on links, you fill in forms, you move the mouse, you fast forward the time. Even you reboot the machine if you see that the next malware stage will only activate after the reboot. And so we go to the website, and if there's a drive-by download being triggered by our user simulation, we get the file, we detonate it as well. But we have also built a very comprehensive and sophisticated phishing detection. So during the sandboxing approach, there are many things we do to find out, hey, is this an attack where there actually is no malicious content, but just some social engineering stuff involved?
How do you pick that up though, right? Like, because that's sort of a little bit outside your traditional lane, right? So you've obviously built that from scratch. What are you looking for there?
Yeah, you're right. That was not our core technology 5 years ago, but over the years, we added more and more detection capabilities. And we have built something here. I mean, we look for the pretty obvious stuff, like if there's a theft icon of PayPal being used on a non-PayPal website, right? If there is some mimicry of a popular website at a different host, if there are some shortened links, if there is some hidden activity, JavaScript, all these things. I mean, of course, I don't want to reveal the real secret thoughts.
But I mean, the fact is that by doing some fairly simple stuff, you knock out like most of it, right, pretty quick. That's the thing. I mean, most of it is about actually having a process to look. You know, it's not like there's incredible voodoo involved in detecting this stuff.
Exactly. Yeah, that's true.
All right, Carsten Willems, thank you very much for joining us on the show to update us on what you've been up to. It's been a real pleasure to chat to you.
Thank you very much for having me, Patrick. Bye.
That was Carsten Willems there. Big thanks to him for that. And big thanks to VMRay for sponsoring the Risky Business podcast this week. You can find them at vmray.com. That's VMRAY.com. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back tomorrow with a Soapbox edition featuring Haroon Mir. That one is super cool and super interesting, so don't miss it. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.